you grew up in Buffalo, is that true?
That's right, Buffalo, New York.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just spoke to Ryan Hurd. I think he was the last person I had on the podcast, and he's originally from Buffalo, but he's
I didn't know that. I know Ryan not well, but I know of him, through the organization.
yeah, yeah. I think Buffalo, I'm from Detroit. It's one of those places that you're from, right?
Right. It was actually a fine place to grow up. I had a good grow, adolescence and young adult there, and then I left.
Yeah, I the same thing. It was really a really nice place to grow up. You had the four seasons, and But then you were so then you were you've been in Boston for a while then.
Yes. Well, I finished my undergraduate work in Buffalo, and then I lived in Israel for 5 years, and then coming back, I came to Boston, and I finished my graduate did graduate school at Boston University, and stayed and had my practice and taught at Boston University as well. So
Oh,
I've been
wow.
in Boston now for quite some time.
Yeah, very nice, very nice. So you're just sort of looking at your bio here. Something that really stuck out for me is the stages of group development from a relational perspective. Your original theory. Okay, tell us what that is, what that means.
Oh, you're I think the first person who's interviewing me about dream work who like picks up on that part of my bio. I was a professor at Boston University School of Social Work, and I was very, very lucky that I was sort of at Group Work Central, and the big names in social group work were professors there. They were some of my professors, and then they were my colleagues when I taught there. So I was teaching in the clinical group work department, and the groups have different stages of development as you join a group. Sort of it's the simplistic is beginning, middle, and end, but then it's broken down even further, and it informs you as a group facilitator. And this is actually very relevant for dream circles as well. So it's something that would be good to know and to incorporate, that both in each session and or the life of a group, people relate in different ways, and they have different styles of connecting with each other, depending on how well they know each other, how long they've been in the group, whether or not they feel safe in the group to share things, and how much they perceive they have in common with each other as well. So some of it unfolds organically, and some of it a good facilitator, if they understand group dynamics, can pick up on and encourage and create a safe space where members feel connected and are able to share not just the easy things to share, but the difficult things as well. So what I did was I took the prevailing model of stages of group development that had been around, that is still used and is still valued and valuable, the Garland Jones Kolodny model, and I adapted it based on self and relation theory. Here in the Boston area is Wellesley College, and they have what's called the Stone Center for Women. And it still is. They are a place of sort of feminist thought and feminist development. So I applied the relational knowledge of how different women and men and genders may develop or connect emotionally to group development.
Yeah. So dream groups are relatively new. Like it just sort of was one-on-one, or maybe you studied it or you talked with your therapist, but the idea of integrating a whole group, and now it's very, very popular, right? Everyone, there's dream groups all over the place.
I don't know when they first began. I have actually no idea who sort of initiated and started doing dream groups. But I know myself, I've been facilitating groups for 35, 40 years, and I've been in a dream circle of my own for I think it'll be 42 years this year.
I would imagine that I'm not in a dream group. I've had a couple offers here from some of the people in BC, and I think I need to get into that. And but it's interesting that you took sort of the same ideas of group therapy and brought them into the dream world. And I would imagine, yeah, it's sort of a one-to-one thing, right? You want to make people sure that they're safe and that the sharing, yeah, and all of that. Did you ever work with the like family constellations? Is that you're like
Yeah, the Hellinger constellation work. Absolutely.
You took a bunch of sessions with this woman that ran over a few months with family constellations in a group thing, and I was amazed at what was happening in there. It was almost magical. That whole setup. And it reminded me also of playback theater, which is something I've explored as well. I have a film and theater background as well. And but that was very, I don't know, very enlightening to see that type of group dynamic play out.
Well, that is very unique, and it's terrific. Family constellation work. I know I can never pronounce her last name, but Diana Ghirardelli, mm-hmm. who is one of the people who do constellation work and do playback theater. She was here in the Boston area for years. And I know the Hellinger work. And it's very connected with Gestalt.
Yeah.
And doing the Gestalt style of dream work, where in Gestalt dream work, you are some aspect of everyone and actually everything in right. your dream as well. So, you know, we could say what's the old man part of you? What is the dog part of you? What is the running brook part of you? And then in constellation work, when members of the group take on aspects of family members and yourself, that in and of itself is incredibly powerful as a therapeutic modality. But when you do that with a dream,
right.
it's like, you know, a marriage of, you know, wonderful techniques all put together.
I think Gestalt needs a comeback, really, because exactly what you're saying, that you take on every aspect of the dream, every part of it, every dream element, everything that's going on. It doesn't matter which, you know, the times that I've worked with, had a Gestalt friend talk me through my dreams, we just randomly picked items and worked through them. And I think not all, but, you know, a lot of times dream interpretation is nowadays like, how are you feeling about it and thinking about the images, but become those images. And now you're sort of tripping a little bit into playback theater as well.
Right.
Yeah.
And Steven Eisenstadt, who's written, what's the name of his book? But his work is all about, actually, I think I have it sitting right here because I'm writing and I have a bunch of books. Oh, Dream Tending. There it is. Mm. He does a lot of focus with the living image in the dream.
Yeah.
And how do we embody and become this living image so that it takes on a life of its own? And that's very connected with the style of embodied work, embodied dream work that borrows from many, many different sort of styles or disciplines, including playback theater, including constellation work, including Gestalt, including psychomotor psychotherapy, including a whole lot of somatic approaches that when we become physically in our dream, when we act out or embody the things or the characters in our dreams, we get an additional level of awareness.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's all about, in dream work, it's about associations anyway. So if I'm associating something from the point of view of myself in a dream, I'm going to have a different association than if I'm associating from the point of view of that rock or that child sitting there.
Yeah. What I noticed in playback theater and family constellations is that they play back the scene to you, or you're guiding the constellation. You're saying, stand here, stand over here, this person here, but you become sort of the main spectator, and this thing is playing out to you, not unlike a dream, you know? So yeah, very much.
You get similar. To it at the same, you get to have a witness perspective at the same time you're watching your own story acted out, which is, you know, a simultaneously multi-layered approach, which is pretty cool.
And it's not like a dream. Yeah. One thing in, I took a weekend class with the psychodrama coach in the Bay Area, and he did this exercise where we were all supposed to, the floor was the map of the world, he said, and everyone sort of stand where you know that your furthest ancestors are from. And so a lot of people were in Ireland and Israel and in Russia and Eastern Europe and stuff like that. And he was saying that a lot of trauma are specific to those particular groups. And so I am trying to bring this around to your new class that you have coming up soon. doing our ancestor song. So there is a little bit of a thread. But yeah, that was pretty enlightening to me. And then also this idea that this thing that it's generational, that it's passed along. And maybe you know this. I remember reading something, it's probably 10 years ago now, but that's passed through like the mothers in a family. Like there's some scientific background to that.
Well, it's really interesting that you mentioned, because I wrote my previous book of PTS dreams, Transforming Your Nightmares from Trauma Through Healing Dreamwork, looks at some of these aspects of where does the trauma begin in when we have a nightmare or when we have nightmares. I can reframe that, you know, what's the difference between a bad dream and a nightmare. And one of the differences is with a nightmare, there's generally speaking, some kind of a traumatic event or series of events that triggers and that is sourcing this nightmare, particularly if it's repetitive. Mm-hmm. There's something you haven't sufficiently resolved that you don't know well enough, and there's something you have to do, and your unconscious is trying to bring it back to you over and over again if you're not attending to it until it sort of hits you over the head and says, listen up, because it's an SOS from our unconscious.
Yeah.
But I actually am writing another book right now that I have a contract with my publisher, with Llewellyn, that the chapter I'm on right now that I'm literally writing is on ancestral dreaming. And the chapter I'm writing is about the somatic effect of multi-generational trauma on our physical bodies in our waking life and in our dreams. Mm-hmm. And how do we heal this ancestral trauma that we're carrying forward? And some of it is, as you were mentioning, from where our families of origin were from and where people in our family histories might have had traumatic events that we aren't still living in. However, we're carrying the imprint, and you may be familiar with the phrase epigenetics. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we're carrying that epigenetic imprint. And the research is showing, I learned this in the process of researching for my book, that literally the eggs in a woman's body are present from the moment the fetus begins to develop. And so what that means is all of the woman's eggs are inside of her mother's body before she's born, and the mother's eggs are inside the grandmother's body before she's born. So we have this literal semi-genetic thread here that is part of the epigenetics. Exactly what you were saying about how it's actually carried in an embodied way from one generation to the next.
That's amazing. So it's sort of these imprints. I'm thinking of like the pre-verbal stage you have as a baby, and what something that came out in the psychodrama class, and then with I think it was the Family Constellations too. There were people that did not know their grandparents. But they knew, for example, one woman's grandmother or family, some family members had perished in the Holocaust, mm-hmm. and another gentleman, his grandfather, something happened in World War I, some atrocity.
Right.
And they were carrying that, and they had never met these people.
Right. And that is exactly what sort of the point of this book I'm writing now is. How do we both receive the gifts of our ancestors and our departed ones that they mm-hmm. have to impart us, and for those of our ancestors who suffered trauma and suffered pain and suffered atrocities, they aren't healed yet, and therefore we aren't either. So this epigenetic layer, there are things that we know in our bodies that we don't know cognitively. And you made a very good point talking about like sort of pre-verbal memories. Mm-hmm. So anything that happened to us from in utero through the ages of 2 or 3, when we start to really develop language, we're not going to have as auditory verbal memories, because our mind isn't yet thinking or creating verbal wordage to express what we're experiencing. Yeah. So those are going to be somatosensory memories. Mm. So your body is going to react or respond to something that's encoded in another sense, in what's called muscle memory or scent memory or sound memory, not in linguistic language memory.
So is it something you could sort of pick up, just sort of the resonant vibe, for example, that a parent is giving off as you're growing up? Maybe they're aloof, or maybe they're angry or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or let's take it even a little less or more subtle. Mm. You know what I mean? Because I noticed within my own family, I had heard stories that my mother, my grandmother, my mom's mother-in-law didn't like her. Right. And then my mom was kind of giving my brother's wife, her, you know, a daughter-in-law grief too. And it was sort of the same thing. And then there was shunning and scapegoating and banishment that was like, this is not, it's not equal to the events that are happening here. So that it sort of made me realize what you're talking about, these imprints, but how do they, I've never really sort of figured out how that is. How that grows within somebody and expresses, and is it sort of a, like I say, like a resonant vibe that you pick up, or is it even deeper within, as you're growing, a bit pre-verbal and all of that? I don't know.
Well, your example is a really good one, even if we just stick with that example. So your mom experienced from her mother-in-law some dissonance that she didn't maybe like her so much, she didn't approve of her, whatever. Yeah. So your mom sort of took that in both in her mind and physically in her body and had reactions to whatever her mother-in-law was saying or doing or not saying or not doing, as the case may be. Uh-huh. So somehow she learned sort of subliminally, if you will, this is how you treat a daughter-in-law. And without being conscious necessarily, it sounds like she passed that sort of muscle memory, that unconscious learning of this is how you treat a daughter-in-law, to her own daughter-in-law. Hmm. And it's not physiological in the sense that we're not inheriting, you know, blue eyes or blonde hair, but we're the way we were treated and the way we were parented, we internalize as if that's the only way to do it. So no matter what our parents' or grandparents' history was, they will parent us, or in-laws as well, for that matter. They will parent us from the point of view of their life experience.
Sure.
And so we grew up being parented by someone who was running for their life, or escaped from the pogroms, or was starving and had to leave Ireland because of the potato famine, or ran from violence in Central America. And now our parents got to America and they're now safe. And we weren't, and they weren't living in those self same situations anymore. There wasn't a famine and there wasn't a pogrom and there weren't gangs attacking our parents, but they parented us from the perspective of parents who lived through it. Mm. And then that's what we got. So without awareness, we unconsciously repeat the pattern.
Yeah, that's just, and I think you just hit on the key word there, that it's unconscious. And so now we've tripped back into dreams there.
But right.
Tell me about this. So dreaming our ancestors home, connecting with and healing our past. Is this a new class that you presented, or is this sort of it's a culmination of a lot of your life's work?
Yes and yes and no. Okay. So D all of the above.
Perfect.
Here's a fun story about my relationship with ancestors and ancestral dreaming and healing. I wrote PTS Dreams, and another member of IASD, a gentleman whose name is Jose, who is an American aid volunteer in the Ukraine. He came across my book and he liked it, and he started using some of the method and techniques from PTS Dreams to help the Ukrainians who are having nightmares because of the war.
Sure.
So he at some point contacted me, and we've had this whole conversation and dialogue since then. And what he didn't know is that my ancestors, my grandfather was born in the Ukraine. He was from Kiev. And they had to run for their lives because of pogroms back in the early 1900s. So what I got is this amazing full circle that I was able, have been able in the work that I'm doing to heal people in a country, in a population where my ancestors were actually persecuted.
Oh, geez.
So it was so powerful. And then I started to have some dreams that were clearly dreams having to do with my ancestors. And there was one dream I had that I worked on. It had to do with borscht, which is the Eastern European, you know, beet soup.
Right.
And so it's this whole dream that I had, and I worked on it, has to do with borscht and what is borscht and beets, and beets are red and they grow in the ground and it's called beet root. So it has to do with roots. Yeah. And in the on and on about the dream. But then I took this work and I created a course that I presented a couple of years ago here in the Boston area at Hebrew College, specifically designed for people who had histories with Holocaust or pogroms in their backgrounds, because it was through Hebrew College. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the template for the course I'm presenting now as well. So it's not solely for people who have had Holocaust or pogrom histories, but anyone who's had trauma in their background that is somehow still seeping in to their life today. And how do we connect through our dreams and through dream work to heal and resolve both for ourselves, but forward and backward in time then, right? To send the healing back to our ancestors and onward to our children and our descendants.
It's amazing that we can do this work, you know, that the world is so connected in the way that it is now. Mm-hmm. For all of the issues around that, I think that the positives outnumber sort of the social media ills that we have. I have a relationship to beets too, because half of my family is from, you know, Eastern Europe, Polish mainly. And I don't really like beets, but I just kind of jokingly say I can't eat them because I think it would be disrespectful to my ancestors, because they fled, you know, they wanted a better life. They didn't want to be eating beets all the time. So it would be almost.
Oh, that's so funny. It's like the same, but opposite. Right. So here's the right. What are our associations? Like, if it was my dream, I was like, oh, I'm going to eat beets more because it's a way to connect. But if it's your dream, it's like, no, beets are our peasant food. And, you know, poor people eat beets and I don't need to eat beets anymore.
Can't stand them. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, that's so funny.
It's so much. I mean, I think in general, like if you were to do dream work or therapeutic work, you know, it's a lot just to process your own life and then to sort of process your ancestral life. Maybe at the most you would get into your relationship with your parents, go really deep with that. But to take it back further, that was what that blew me away about family constellations and the work that you're saying as well. And, you know, I'm a practicing Tibetan Buddhist, so I add another layer of reincarnation on top of that. It's a thousand times more complicated. But at the end of the day, you still have to resolve these issues that you have, right?
Right. Yeah. And when we're talking about ancestors, there's the literal sort of like who's in your family line, your sort of genetic, you know, family tree. Mm-hmm. But ancestors can also be people we're not related to, such as were we reincarnated from another being or another time and place. And when we think about ancestors in an even larger sense, about the earth.
Human, and our
oldest ancestor is, you know, Mother Earth, is Gaia. So how are we connected to and relating to that ancestral lineage, as well as whatever our karmic connections are with reincarnated folks who weren't in our family line, and then our family line too?
Yeah, yeah. And now you're also using the Torah and the Kabbalistic style of reading the Torah as part of this class. So you're bringing your heritage in that as well.
Right, yeah. Right. This is the Pardes method that I designed. The Pardes is a word in Hebrew. It means orchard. Mm-hmm. And it's analogous to the Garden of Eden. So when we think about the first orchard, that's it. But it also is An anagram for each letter stands for another layer of depth. So the P stands for, in Hebrew, the word is pshat, and the word translation is simple. And the R is remez, which is hinted at. The D is dalid, which is drash in Hebrew, which is the pursued or revealed layer. And then the final S in pardes is sod, which in English translates as secret or mystery. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at multiple simultaneous layers of depth when we explore a dream, from the storyline itself, just the dream as we dreamt it, to our first hints and our first associations without having to work too hard at them, to the next layer of when we use multiple methods of dream work, whether it's gestalt or whether it's image rehearsal therapy or whether it's from focusing body-oriented Gendlin's work, to get to additional depth, or whether we're doing writing or drawing. And then the final layer, the sod, is when we get to the transpersonal layer, the mystical layer, the spiritual layer of the dream that has potential meaning, not only for ourselves, but for others in the world as well. Hmm. So we can dream for ourselves and we can dream for others. Sometimes it's a dream that's for the collective.
So it's sort of your have different layers of subtlety as you're moving down, and sort of almost a character analysis.
It's definitely different layers of subtlety, and I don't know if I'd call it character analysis, but it's simply, it's like a prism, right? And if you turn the prism, you get different facets and different colors will show up. So as you turn the dream and you work with it, you get different facets and different aspects of it that show up as you look at it from various perspectives.
Yeah. So I've never studied Kabbalistic teachings or anything like that. I've tried, and it seems like it's a pretty, there's a little bit of a steep learning curve coming in. I would imagine that if it's part of your heritage and you grow up with it, it's easy. But it is sort of the esoteric aspect of the Torah and just the whole Hebrew, the Old Testament. I grew up Catholic, and so
yeah,
we understood. I actually read the whole Bible at one point when I was studying with the Rosicrucians, so a little bit of an understanding of that. But maybe can you just explain for just in general, in 25 words or less, what the whole idea of Kabbalah?
Sure. Well, it's funny because most people who grew up in any religious tradition are not versed or connected with the mystery traditions, with the esoteric practices. Yeah. So people who grew up Jewish are ordinarily no more learned about Kabbalah than someone who grows up Catholic, unless they made a point, their own orientation, right, was to go to the mystery or to go to study that. Mm-hmm. So like Sufis, right? What's the relationship of Sufism to Islam? Well, there's a relationship, but it's far afield. Yeah. And in Christian tradition, there's a whole set of mystery traditions as well. And I've heard that the mystery branches, if you will, of each tradition often have more in common with each other than they do with their parent religion.
I would say that, yeah. I think there's certain groupings, and you could even apply this to Hindu and Buddhism. There's people that just want to go and they want to do the rituals, and then there's the tantric stuff, for example.
Right, yeah. Exactly right. So Kabbalah, the word itself, means received. So this is received information or received knowledge, and it isn't simple and quick and easy. And in the olden days, you had to be over 40, married, and male, right, to study Kabbalah. Luckily, in modern times, you don't have to be married or male anymore, because human beings can reach a stage where they can grasp esoteric and spiritual concepts. However, you do have to have a certain amount of wisdom to be able to grasp something that has no shape or form or ability to hold on to in that way. Mm. So it's the spiritual aspect of interacting with the divine in a variety of different forms, that some of them are ritual based and some of them are internal and some of them are cognitive, but there's many, again, people can study Zohar, which is the holy book of the Kabbalah, you know, all their life and only get to like, you know, one pin, you know, fingernails worth of information. Mm. Because it's any mystical tradition, it's partially experiential as well as learning.
And are there different schools and different teachers and different branches as well?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. There's the basic history that started in 14th century Spain, that then people left Spain again, pogroms and the Inquisition specifically, and went to Safat in Israel, where the seat of the Kabbalah was with Joseph Caro and a few other. The Lurianic tradition is the main one. And interestingly, Carl Jung was a student of Kabbalah. And he incorporated Kabbalistic thought and practice into some of his work. Yeah. And I don't know if you've ever looked closely at a tarot card as well. If you look at the tarot cards, every card has a Hebrew letter on it well. So this idea of, you know, it's, what is it? In Hebrew, it's gematria, numerology. So this numerology and the meaning of the numbers of the letters, it, you know, is a piece there as well, as is the tree of life, which is one of the more well-known aspects of Kabbalistic thought and practice.
And that is actually, when I do the tarot, that is the layout that I do. It's called the tree of life.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
There's 10 cards that you lay down, and it very much looks just like that tree of life.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah. So you're doing a tarot reading using the Sefarot, which are the 10 emanations of the divine. Yep. And you're using that as your layout. Yep. In tarot. That is so cool.
Yeah, it looks exactly like it.
Wow.
So can people come to your take this session without sort of a Jewish background and get something out of it, or is it more geared towards people of the Jewish faith?
Well, I think anyone could come, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's presented through an organization called Ritual Well, which is a Jewish organization, but we are not going to be focusing. We'll be focusing on whatever people bring. Mm-hmm. Right. So what you bring to the workshop will be what we use, and we'll be doing dream work, connecting with our ancestral heritage, and whatever your ancestral heritage is what we'll pay attention to. And we'll use some of these practices that I've developed to connect with receiving the gifts. If we have ancestors who say, "You haven't been paying attention. I'm trying to tell you something important. Here's a gift for you." And or the ancestors who are saying, "We are still suffering. We are still in pain. We really need your help." Or the ancestors who are still holding a grudge, for that matter, or saying, sure, "We're really, you know, still mad about X, Y, or Z that happened. And, you know, we're going to keep bothering you about it. And what do we do then?" Right? Because there's a layer of that too sometimes.
Interesting.
If you even think like, you know, the Montagues and the Capulets and Romeo and Juliet, you know, there's a long grudge story there that ultimately wasn't healed until they both died. And hopefully we can heal before more people have to die from grudges.
How about yourself in your own personal dreams with ancestors? Any stories that you'd like to share?
Well, there are two. Well, the one story that I started to share a piece of was about the beets. And in that dream, I'm supposed to teach students how to make beet soup, how to make borscht, only we don't have the right materials. And the chef in the restaurant that I'm in says, "Oh, that's okay. I have a shredder for you. And you need a shredder in order to make this beet soup." So I said, "Oh, great. Now I have the right tools that I need to make it." And I go back to the kitchen where my students are, and they've all started to try to make this recipe, but they failed miserably because they don't have the right tools. So I say, "Hey, we have to start over. We have to go back. And I have the shredder now." So there's a whole, you know, multiple layers of And then they agree, and then we do it. So, you know, what is the whole thing, the connection with my ancestors around the beats, which I already talked about, and then this machine, right, this shredder.
Yeah, what's the shredder?
Exactly, that's the question. So then I worked with a dear friend of mine on like unpacking the dream, because, you know, we can't see the back of our own head without a mirror. So I encourage people to work with at least one other person, if not with a group of people, to help understand a dream.
Yeah.
So we talked about it, and she asked me what my associations for Shredder was. And there were a number of different associations. One was, well, with the beets in particular, it makes them more digestible and easier to eat. Because a beet is like a hard object, and you've got to kind of cut it up. You don't just eat a whole beet, you know, by itself. So a shredder helps us to metabolize and then digest the beets. Okay. So when we're thinking about ancestry, what do we need to metabolize and what do we need to digest from our ancestral line? And that's sort of on a positive side. And then another association was shredder is like, ouch, like something that's shredded is kind of ripped to shreds and can be very painful. So then I'm thinking about, oh, so here in my ancestral history, there was a time when this was painful. And my family was shredded and needed to run. Mm-hmm. So how do we find some resolution with the two different associations to shredder?
Yeah, and I think too, once you start getting into dream work, if you're just starting and you start to see these aspects of yourself that you've perhaps been denying or that are just coming up as you get more and more dreams, it's gonna shred who you were, you know?
Your self-conception,
Yeah. I like you said that you create a container of safety that's very alchemical.
Well, both doing one-on-one work and also doing dream work, to have that holding environment, that felt sense of safety, and that this is a place where no matter what happens, you've already have some resources to be able to fall back on. And that's the element of working with PTS dreams and using the Gaia method that I designed starts with resources as well. It starts with gathering up your resources and your posse, your people, your pets, your friends, your relatives, living or dead, whoever and whatever, you know, your magic wand from Harry Potter, whatever makes you feel safe,
so
that you've got the resources that you didn't have in the original nightmare. Or you didn't have in the original experience, but now you do. So part of the job of the facilitator then is to help you stay connected to the resources so that you can then go to the scary places and this time have a different experience.
Yeah.
And this time to be accompanied and not be alone with whatever the terror is.
Wow. Yeah, I just love, you know, your background and all the things, how you've incorporated into your work. It's just, it's beautiful. It's really wonderful. Yeah. What else? I had to laugh. I was reading your website and you're talking about all your background and all these different acronyms. And then you say, in her free time. What free time?
Yeah.
I have a hard time with discipline sometimes. I really just want to play in life and take time to just kill time. But discipline's important, I think. If you're going to be doing this work, especially, like, I'll wake up from a dream sometime and I go, oh, that's odd. And then a part of me is like, well, you know, put it into the tape recorder. Another part of me is like, we're going to have to unpack that. And so it's hard work, you know, to shred yourself through this process, dream analysis.
Yeah. You know, you have, you know, multiple choices too. Like, you can wake up from a dream and you can go, never mind.
Yeah.
Which is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. And you can wake up from a dream and say, well, let me just get it down. Let me write it down or speak it into my device, however you're recording it, and then never look at it.
Yeah.
That's okay too. And then you can, sometimes though, the dreams have a mind of their own, right? Or a life of their own. Mm-hmm. And they'll kind of haunt you if you don't work with them.
Yeah.
And then it's not a question of, oh, I just want to go play. I see you have a, I think I'm seeing a guitar in the corner there.
Right.
Yeah. I'm going to go play my guitar, or I'm going to go take a walk, or, which is great. We have to do that. But if the dream has said, pay attention, this is really important.
Yeah.
If you listen, it's not, there's nothing else you'd rather do.
Yeah. What I find
at
is
that
what,
moment.
I always transcribe them at some point. And then I'm always surprised when I do that to say, I don't remember that, you know, so it's important, I think, that you do that. And
absolutely.
and it's something crazy. And the dream elements are like, wow, like, how did I not want to like go into that? But mm-hmm. yeah, so this is for myself personally, I really have to push myself to want to explore it. I had a dream last night where I figured out some problem at work that I needed to figure out some piece of code that I need to do. And then,
you a computer guy coding?
Yeah, well, I do technical writing. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
But I'm trying to figure out this program, and I figured it out in the dream, but I woke up, I couldn't remember it. And I think it was more like the idea that I could figure it out. It wasn't the exact thing that needed to be figured out yet. So
depending on whether it's important or not to you to figure it out or to know what it was you dreamt about, you can do a couple of things to retrieve that. One is, and you probably know some of this, but maybe all your listeners don't, you can do dream incubation.
Right, that's big.
Right,
yeah.
And you know, in simple form, it means you have an issue, a dilemma, a problem, a question that you want answered. And for you, it could be, I figured out the answer to the coding last night, but I don't remember it. And so your incubation is, let me please remember the answer to my coding question. And you write that down in your dream journal, and you put your attention on it and have that be the thing you try to consciously sort of take in before you go to sleep. And your mm-hmm. dream will come with an answer.
What works best for incubation for me is to have the doorway idea, like rather than trying to think this is what I'd like to dream about, I mm-hmm. sort of start like, I have imagery, whatever it may be, like I'm going to go through this particular door or go to this particular landscape,
right.
And focus on that as I'm falling asleep, and
nice.
that will usually kind of guide me into maybe even lucidity. Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Right. And another word that is often used is that's the portal.
Portal, yeah.
Right, that takes you into, you know, another world, another dimension, another plane. Yeah.
Cool.
And the other thing, do you know about muscle memory?
A little bit, sure.
Yeah. Well, this is, I love this part of dream work, and of, if you had a dream and you woke up and maybe you didn't write it down, but all of a sudden you're taking a shower or you're brushing your teeth and you go, oh, I had a dream, but I can't remember it at all. Go back to bed. Put your body in the same position that you slept in. So if you sleep on your right side with your knees kind of bent and your arms curled up, lie down in that position and kind of just let your body relax. Don't try to do anything. And often the dream will come back because of the muscle memory of your body being in the same position as when you dreamt it.
Wow, I've never tried that.
I love that. It always amazes me every time it really, really works.
Mm-hmm. One thing I do a lot is play my guitar in my dreams. I'll just practice particular songs. And maybe there's a particular phrase, like a Stevie Wonder song or something. He has a lot of sort of chords that move in odd directions that aren't typical. And there'll be a particular phrase that I haven't gotten yet, I haven't figured out. And then in my dream, I can figure it out. And then I come back and play. It's like, yeah, it was exactly what this exact chord or progression that, yeah. So
that's great. You know, a lot of, I'm sure you do, but a lot of famous scientific, medical, you know, engineering discoveries were from people dreaming about them.
And it's not just your mind. I've heard of classical pianists, like when they're traveling maybe on a train or on a plane or something, they're playing their thing like measure by measure in their head and watching their fingers, you know, their visualization. So, you know, why not bring that into your dreams if you're trying to, for example, figure out something in your life, whatever it is, a problem or, you know, technical thing or a creative thing. Yeah, let your dreams do the work. I've always
absolutely.
Done that too. When I'm writing, if I have a creative thing that I'm writing fictional, I usually let my subconscious do the work. You know, I'll come back if I'm stuck or something. I'll go, okay, this part here, there's something wrong in this scene. And I'll be back on Friday and I'll come back and let it know. I'll be back on Friday. And then I come back on Friday and I have the answer to what I need. So
that's great. So you have a very nice relationship with your dreaming self.
I think so. that
you can say, hey, you know, get me set up for Friday. And it, you know, complies because you've been feeding it the right food.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's half our life, right? Our unconscious being, and so afraid of it. It's, you know, it's called the devil, you know, and things like that. So yeah. Well, wonderful. Wonderful. So you said you're working on a new book.
Yeah.
Is that you were down in Sarasota, Florida? Is that what you said?
Yes. I had a combination writing retreat vacation. I have some friends down in Sarasota. So my husband and I went down, and I've never gone away for 3 weeks before.
3 weeks. Wow. Yeah.
It was great. And so I didn't have any of the, I didn't see any of my clients, and I didn't have any doctor's appointments or errands I had to do. I mean, we had to go grocery shopping. Yeah. But aside from that, I wrote every day. There was a pool with the house we were staying at, and I swam. And then in the evenings, you know, we saw friends. So it was easier to be disciplined when, you know, you're away from your daily life and the demands of, like, you know, vacuum the rug and take care of the cat and take care of your kids or whatever it is, you know, you're doing.
Yeah. And so were you just starting the book, or was you're just kind of digging into it a little more, or what was the,
well, I'm about halfway through at this point. Mm-hmm. It was really fun last summer. I was actually, here's a waking dream. I was at the conference in, where was it last summer? In
Ashland?
Oregon?
Yeah.
Ashland. Yes, it was in Ashland. So I was in Ashland, and I was sitting by the pool, and I were talking with a few friends who were there. And I get a message on my phone from the acquisitions editor at Llewellyn. And she said, hi, you know, we're looking at our schedule for the next year or two, and we're wondering if you're writing anything, because we'd like to have another book from you. Wow. It's like, oh my God, this is like a dream. And I said, funny you should mention it. I've actually started, you know, thinking about another book, and I was just about to start putting a proposal together to send to you. So she said, well, you know, we don't need a whole proposal because we already know you're writing, but send me a table of contents and send me a synopsis. And then, you know, it just happened, and I got a new contract for this book.
Nice.
It was really like a dream come true.
What is your writing process like? Do you get up at 4 a.m. or do you just only have time on the weekends, or how do you?
I'm not a morning person. I don't get up at 4 a.m. God bless those of you who do.
Can't do it either. Yep.
I need a chunk of time, like at least if I'm going to be doing some serious writing, I want to have an uninterrupted span of at least 3 hours.
Yeah.
So that I can kind of focus, because I don't know about other people, but what I do is I'll often reread what I've already written, and I'll do some editing, and then I'm researching, and at some point I'll catch the breeze, and I'm off writing the next thing. But I have to sort of sit and kind of like walk around it for a little while and look at it from a few different directions, and then I'm ready to go. But what helps me personally is, I think, yeah, with all the books, I have a table of contents, and that's my outline.
And you just work from that, yeah.
So then I work from that. And sometimes it'll change. Like in this book I'm writing now, I've written a couple of chapters, and I realize, you know, I don't have a chapter yet on grief per se, grief and dreaming, and grief and dreaming and ancestors. So I added that chapter in there, like specifically. Mm. But in general, I have this table of contents I'm working off of that helps me kind of stay organized. I don't know. Do you do that? Because you write mostly fiction or nonfiction?
Yeah, I'll try to write by the seat of my pants sometimes, but for this novel I'm getting ready to start, or I'm, you know, already in, I'm going really heavy on the outlining and character analysis and things like that. Just because I think it'll be a lot easier to do that way.
Yeah. I would think that if you're writing a novel, you kind of have to have a trajectory of where you're going and what's going to happen. And I know sometimes your characters will surprise you. I've heard from friends who write novels, like, I didn't think she was going to do that.
Yeah.
But here she is doing that.
The hardest part really for fiction is that every time you write, so I mostly wrote screenplays for a while, but I'm doing short stories and novels now. Every new project that you write, you have to learn how to write from scratch again, unless you're going to write the same thing over and over, your Harry Potters or Game of Thrones, where, okay, that's my style, blah, 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 I have it. But if you're writing something that's different, every time you sit down to do it, your style is going to be a little different. So did you work on the computer, I would imagine? Do you write longhand?
Yeah. Well, I take notes. Sometimes I have lots of little like scraps of paper that I jot things down on, or if I'm reading something and it's like, oh, that's really interesting, I'll like stick a bookmark in. But when I'm writing, I'm doing it on the computer.
Yeah. Longhand on paper, there's something, and maybe you know this because you have some neurobiology background. When you're looking down, there's something about the way that your eyes are taking in information, as opposed to like this, sitting straight up. Like there's more intensity, and that makes sense. Like you're really just focused on this little area here. Even a typewriter, right, from the old days, that's still kind of a narrow focus here, but now you have this big thing that's computer screen, and it's part of the wider world, and your eyes just kind of don't have as much focus. There's a different focus. There's a greater focus that comes from longhand, and I've discovered that. But the problem is, then you got to take that and put it into the computer, right?
Well, it's really interesting. I love that you are mentioning this, the neurobiology of writing, right, and of dreaming. So for me, I have a laptop. I don't have a great big screen. So for my focus is pretty narrow. Yeah. And right now I have the computer up on a like a little platform thing so that I can sort of look straight ahead. But when I'm writing, it's on my desk. So I'm actually kind of looking down.
You are looking down, okay.
A little bit at my screen. And sometimes, because I'm a terrible typist, sometimes I actually have to see what my fingers are doing. Yeah. When we're writing longhand, we're tapping into that muscle memory we were talking about, the physiology of our thoughts and feelings in an embodied way. Yeah. That's different than typing. Absolutely.
Well, I remember, yeah, when word processors first came along, I was like, this is great. This is going to be amazing. But it's like you're saying, you go back and you re-edit it and then you look something up, and it's not a good thing in some ways. It really forces you to be disciplined. Because if you're longhand, you can just, you can really go on a tear sometimes, right? Whereas, but I guess it sounds like you have that, like you hit some type of singularity, and then boom, you have it. And then you just,
when I get in the zone, right? Yeah, yeah. Then I'm good. But when I'm working with people if I'm doing sort of automatic writing or writing off of a prompt from a dream, we always do handwriting, you know, on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
To stay with the spiritual, emotional, physical flow of whatever wants to come through. It seems to come through in a different way if you're writing, because you're engaging like many more muscles if you're writing than if you're just moving your fingertips.
Yeah. Oh, the subconscious and unconscious, just, it's a gold mine.
Yeah. It really is. That's the beauty of dream work, to get to dig for that gold.